The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia Online. I'm Laura Kovacs, and I'm pleased to be here. Dr. Yaba Play is a scholar activist, public speaker, and cultural consultant whose work and scholarship centers on the lived experiences of Black women and girls, with a particular focus on identity, body politics, and beauty practices. She has launched a number of viral media campaigns, produced the CNN documentary, Who is Black in America? And her work has appeared in publications such as the New York Times, Essence, and Ebony. In one drop, she questions conventional perceptions of Blackness in order to create and understand a more diverse worldwide community. This evening, she'll be joined in conversation with Imani Perry. Dr. Perry is the Hughes Rogers Professor of African American Studies at Princeton and the author of 6 books, most recently the award-winning titles Breathe, A Letter to My Sons, and Looking for Lorraine, The Radiant and Radical Life of Lorraine Hansberry. And now the screen is all yours.
Good evening. Welcome. Thank you all for joining us for what I know will be a great conversation. And of course, Imani, thank you so much for being here with me. Before we get to start our chat, I want to give a brief presentation. I know a number of you have probably joined some of the other conversations I've been in, so this might be repetitive for you, but I do think it's important to share some background information and some context before we jump into a conversation. So I'm going to go ahead and share my screen and get started. So this is the cover of my book, One Drop, Shifting the Lens on Race. The book focuses on Black racial identity and skin color politics, and in many ways, it represents a conversation about Blackness and considers questions of who's Black, who cares, who's not, and why. Rather than to tell you the specific details of the book, because of course, if you haven't already, you're going to purchase your own copy from our own local Uncle Bobby's. But for now, I just want to give you some context to understand how it is I chose to do this work and why. Generally speaking, my work, scholarship, and practice center on the lived experiences of Black people, capital B. And for me, Black represents a global identity. Not only a global identity, but a political one. One that not only reflects race, but also culture. And within my work on Blackness, I have focused my attention on colorism and skin color politics. Pretty straightforward, right? Well, flashback to 2010, I was on a panel with this woman, Rosa Clemente, hip hop activist, community organizer in 2018, Green Party vice presidential candidate. And we were on a panel together at the Caribbean Cultural Center. The topic was colorism throughout the diaspora. And for as well-versed and as learned as I thought myself to be on global Black identities, I found myself distracted each and every time she self-identified as, quote, a Black Puerto Rican woman from the South Bronx, end quote. I mean, yes, I know Puerto Ricans. I know Puerto Ricans are of some African descent, but I, at the time, did not know any Puerto Ricans who claimed Blackness at the forefront of their identities. Where I grew up, there wasn't a large Latinx community, and there certainly wasn't a large Afro-Latinx community. You see, I grew up Black as I am in New Orleans, Louisiana, a city that has a long history of color consciousness, color-coded society. There you're either Black, white, or Creole. And in my experience, folks who had the privilege of identifying as Creole did. And in my experience, or rather my opinion, they were just saying that they were Creole, so they didn't have to say that they were Black. In my experience, many Creoles rejected Blackness. In my experience, many Creoles rejected me. I remember not being invited to the birthday party of one of my very best friends in elementary school because she said, her mama said, I was too Black. I also remember as an adult not being invited to an adult colleague's wedding for the very same reason. So as far as I was concerned, Creoles didn't want to be Black and didn't have to be. And so anytime I encountered one or anyone who even looked like one, I already knew who they were or who they weren't, or so I thought. But in meeting Rosa, I started questioning a lot. I started rethinking what I thought I knew, not only about folks who looked a particular way, but about Blackness in general. And so I embarked on this project as I wanted to investigate what I was then calling the other side of Blackness. I interviewed over 70 people representing 25 different countries and countries of origin, ranging in age from 21 to 103 years old. 58 of them are included in the book. The book not only features short narratives, which I wrote based upon our interviews, but it also includes a portrait of each of the contributors. Shout out to Noelle Teard, who is director of photography on the project, who also created most of these portraits herself. And while the contributors all use a variety of terms to self-identify, they all see themselves as part of the larger racial and cultural group generally referred to as Black folks. All of them have had the experience of having their identity called into question based upon their appearance. And most of them have been asked, what are you? Or the more politically correct, where are you from? Time and time again. The very first question that I ask each of them is, how do you identify racially and or culturally? Black Puerto Rican. Black from Louisiana. Black Latina. Black and or mixed race. Mixed and or Black. Black of mixed heritage. Afro-Cuban and or Black. African-American. Black. African. Mixed and or Jamaican. Black. Black-American Muslim. Black. Part of the purpose of this book is to examine how it is that we as Black people come to identify and define ourselves. Historically, this graphic represents what it has meant to be Black by law. In the history of the United States, a Black person has been defined as any person with any known Black African ancestry. Although this definition has been referred to as the one Black ancestor rule, the traceable amount rule, the rule of hypo descent, it is more popularly known as the one drop rule, meaning that any single solitary drop of African blood is enough to render a person Black. Said differently, the one drop rule holds that a person with any trace of Black African ancestry, however small or invisible, cannot be considered white. They must be considered Black. Understand that this one drop rule, looking at this graphic going back five generations, this one drop rule was instituted ultimately to protect whiteness. Whiteness was defined as pure. You should know that no other ethnic group is defined or counted according to the one drop rule. You should also know that the one drop rule is characteristically American, meaning that in no other nation or society does this rule have applicability or even make any bit of sense. In fact, in many places for a person of African descent, any one drop of anything else is enough to render them something else. In the introduction of the book, I map out the history of how it is that the United States came to adopt such a specific and seemingly quantitative definition of Black identity. And it was important for me to provide that context first, because I want us to think critically about how it is that we as Black people come to identify and define ourselves. Many of us have accepted the one drop rule as our own, but truth is, we didn't create it. Because of this, many others of us reject the one drop rule and resent definitions of Blackness that don't originate with Black people. So once we come to know and understand the history of race, the history of the one drop rule, My question is, does that necessarily mean that we should reject it altogether? And if the answer is yes, my next question is, how then might we quantify Blackness as a group identity? How might we qualify Blackness as a group identity? Who would be Black and why? Or better stated, who would be Black and how? A large part of what I'm attempting to do with this project is to get us to reimagine Blackness, if you will. It is not my goal to tell people how to identify. It is my goal, however, that we begin to understand the politics of our identities and the politics of Blackness. So now it's me and you, Imani.
It's so wonderful to be able to talk to you about this extraordinary book. One of the things, and you just said it, that I love about it is that you both have this sort of, this set of absolutely beautiful photographs and narratives, but you historicize the construction of race. You're attentive to the processes of self-identification and self-description. And I was wondering if, you could talk about, this project begins in 2010 formally, although you had many prior years of thinking about race and racialization. And it strikes me, and I wonder if you agree, that just over the past decade, these conversations about who counts as Black have begun to shift. I can't tell if it's necessarily generational. Is it because of the expanded cultures of Blackness in the United States? For example, for me, I just take the one drop rule for granted as something expansive and beautiful, but I know that many younger people in my life do not.
Right. And don't understand it, don't understand why we would even accept it, and also have much more narrow, I think, ideas of Blackness. I know that when I released the book in 2013, end of 2013 into the beginning of 2014, I don't know what I was expecting in terms of a response, because there was already a lot of public engagement with the project, particularly because of the CNN documentary. But what was striking to me was the pushback, and where the pushback came from. And primarily it came from folks who either identified as mixed or biracial, who somehow believed that I was forcing them to be Black, or saying that everyone that was mixed or biracial was Black, and ending the conversation there, but also from white mothers of biracial and mixed race children who somehow thought that in so forcing them to be Black, that I was leaving them out of their own children's identity. It was very interesting. Very interesting. But I agree. I think in the last 10 years, I don't know what to point to, but I think there has been a lot more public conversation, but also a lot more policing of Blackness, gatekeeping of Blackness online. I know I've had conversations with college age students who are just like, oh yeah, that person's not Black. And then when I try to engage them about why, it's just like, because they're not, they don't have a formulated, response necessarily to it. And it's like, for them, it just becomes very literal. Like, if I don't read you as Black, or if you're not doing things that they regard as Black, then there are all these other things you can be. So go and be those things. And of course, my question is like, okay, let's, sit there for a minute and try to understand this. Like, what is the function of doing that? And how does it serve us to create particular narrow identities and narrow ideas of Blackness, particularly as we, compare historical moments in time?
Yeah, it seems like a piece of this, and I know this is also an area of expertise very particularly for you, is about a really robust conversation about colorism. So one of the things I keep thinking about is, when I see Afro-Latinx folks saying, oh, now everybody wants to claim Afro-Latinx, but you are considered white or close to white, right? Speaking to people who are very light-skinned,
right?
In our home nations or nations of origin. I wonder, what's the balance in the conversation between self-definition,
genealogy and how people are seen and advantaged or disadvantaged based upon color.
It's so nuanced, complicated, layered, you know, which makes it exciting to me to like talk about, because I don't think any of us should take a position like this is the answer, right? So even for me, revisiting this project X amount of years later, I knew for certain that one area that I wanted to dig into and seek insight was that the Afro-Latinx identity, because I'm not Afro-Latinx, right? And recognizing, as you said, that in the public sphere, in this public conversation, there is so much more gatekeeping and policing and conversation about who's being considered Afro-Latinx. And why? And so interesting enough, I just had a conversation, I posted it on my Instagram last week with three women, part of an organization called Radio Caña Negra, and they do specific work on anti-Blackness in Latin America, right? And so it was a very eye-opening conversation for me because, again, centering myself, when I started on this project, when I encountered Rosa and then came to be connected with so many other people who identified as Afro-Latinx or Black, it was eye-opening and affirming to me somehow because of my lived experience as a dark-skinned woman in New Orleans. I was used to people rejecting Blackness. I was used to people who had the opportunity to identify as something else, choosing something else, right? So this is the first time I'm meeting folks who could claim another identity. They're like, no, I'm Black. That was dope to me. I'm like, yes, where y'all at? Right? I'm ready to talk to all y'all. And so in speaking with these sisters, what became very clear is that A, what is a Latinx identity? Because where they are from, there's no Afro anything. The word is negra. They're Black, right? That Afro Latinx identity, not that it is an American creation, but it's something that is more, I want to say, pronounced, right, in the American context. But for them, there aren't these questions of who's who in the home country, because we have very similar racial politics around that hierarchy of white and Black and then folks in between, right? But then also for them, the question is, this Afro-Latinx identity for a lot of people seems to be a choice, that you have the ability, right, to navigate and float as a choice. You can be Afro-Latinx in the American context, but you can go to home country and be something else. And that for folks who are Black, we don't have those kinds of choices, right? So why do you choose it in one context and allow it to kind of slide, you know, in another? The idea that J-Lo can identify as Afro-Latinx based upon what? A DNA test? Is it about the blood or is it about the lived experience? Right? So when we have these questions about identity, yes, we should all be able to come up with our own identity. Tiger said he's Cablan Asian, but how many other Cablan Asians are there, Tiger? Right? And do the police care when they stop you? Or are you Black? Right? And so again, it's this question, this dance between who am I? Is it about who I am? Is it about who others say I am? How I'm perceived? Is it about how I live? Like all of these questions of how we come to identify ourselves, which again is interesting to me. And I like diving into the conversations just to push us to think about it. Because like you, for those of us who are recognizably Black, when have we ever been asked to define Blackness? It's a given. So now we, to be pushed to have a conversation to define it, it's challenging, but for me, it's challenging in a good way.
That's beautifully stated. And, you know, one of the things that I, the many things that I love is that about your work in this book and generally is that there's this kind of intimacy and attentiveness to the emotional registers of identity. But also, you know, you really talk about political Blackness, right? That it's not, you know, that there it is something that is that affects your experience, your encounters, your self-conception, but it's also a social and political reality. And I think in some ways you have this unique intersection of experiences, right? Ghanaian American, New Orlean, right? Studying in the first African American studies doctoral program in the country, working at HBCUs and PWIs. And so I guess one of the things that I want to ask you, because you have all of these vantage points, is what is it that people don't get? And I mean both Black people and the larger society. Like, what is the thing that you try to open up for people that seems to be like a roadblock or multiple things to understanding the complexity of Blackness?
Yeah, I think there are a lot of things, you know. I always say I'm probably too Black for my own good, but I'm definitely in a space where I want folks to understand Blackness as a broad identity, as a global identity, understand the nuances of it. But in my experience, again, from teaching in Africana studies and Black studies, but then also having positions on college campuses and in the multicultural diversity, inclusion, equity, belonging realm. Mm-hmm. And then also, I just think this moment that we're, and maybe it's not a moment, it feels like a moment, but I'll call it a we are the world moment, right? That we have people who will deflect and say, well, you know, race doesn't matter, or we're all members of the human race, and why are y'all making such a big deal about race? You know, that kind of thing. And I just wonder if we're being deluded to believe that the goal, right? Like whatever winning might look like, or whatever victory might look like over this moment, would be to get to a place where we can all just get along and hold hands and be the human race. And for me, that's the setup and that's the delusion, because we just want to get past the pain of the moment and set the goal of getting along. And we refuse to look at that history. Like, if you don't address this history, you don't understand why that can't be the goal. That's not, like, race is a thing, right? And it's not just a thing based upon what you look like, or the idea that there are boxes that we have to check just to be categorized. When I say the politics of Blackness, all I mean is that there are negotiations of power at play.
Yes.
So if we want to get to new definitions of race, what is the function of that going to be? Because the function of defining whiteness in a particular way in a particular moment of time was to consolidate power. Yes. The function of defining Blackness by the one drop rule is to make a very small number, right? Make it limited, as much mixing, so-called mixing that was happening. We're going to solidify power with a small group of people who can allege to have pure ancestry. Everybody else who doesn't have pure ancestry, then you're not in this elite club. So that race served a function in this moment. What function does it serve now? And is that different? Mm-hmm. So why would we delude ourselves into believing that we can just erase all of that, hold hands, hug, and accept each other as human beings? You know, it's like one of those things where, you know how you just can't unsee certain things?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. How are we going to undo race? Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? So for me, these kind of...
I said certainly not by avoiding it.
No. And so for me, these conversations are about looking the thing in the face, mm-hmm. you know, dealing with what it is, so that perhaps we can have a better understanding and therefore maybe, I don't know, set different expectations. Mm-hmm. Like, yes, in theory, I think for us, right, a goal is to do away with oppression, do away with racism, do away with white supremacy. Is it going to happen in our lifetime, Imani? Let's not set ourselves up. But that doesn't mean we don't chip away. We don't keep chipping away at it, right? But we got to call the thing what it is first and foremost.
Truth teller. You are. I want to encourage people to ask questions, and I want to, I'm looking through the questions that have already been asked. And one of them, which I'm going to modify just a little bit, but is about Meghan Markle, the Duke and Duchess of Sussex. And it's an interesting case because this is a kind of transnational, like imperial history dynamic for thinking about Blackness and mm-hmm. the controversies around the, you know, the crown and Blackness. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And so, you know, so the question is about the one drop rule there, but I think is more broad, is also about how you make sense of what that is.
I feel like it's a wonderful example, right? Mm-hmm. Because it says to me, again, no different than another moment in history, how invested people are in whiteness being pure.
Yes.
Right? Particularly now we're going to add royalty to the mix. Right? So, you know, in a lot of ways, Meghan could likely pass in some situations, right? If we didn't know that her mama was Black, right? Many of us would say, well, she's probably mixed with something, you know? But in some instances, people who may not have that kind of acute racial lens might see her potentially as a white woman, right? But the minute we know, so again, it's not what you look like. The minute we know that your blood is mixed with the thing that we've been oppressing for so long, the thing that we've been saying is so much different than us for so long, because within the ideology of white supremacy, it's not just about colors, white and Black. It's about what whiteness and Blackness have represented. Whiteness has represented humanity and civilization. Blackness has been projected as barbaric, right? Closer to animals. These are all things that were said and written to justify our enslavement and oppression, because we weren't even seen as human beings. So when we get this one drop rule, the idea is that drop of Blackness somehow taints your whiteness and makes you less civilized. How much more royal? You know what I'm saying? Like, yeah. What's one drop of Blackness going to do to your royalty? So to me, it's an example that's screaming in our faces how invested we are in particular ideas of whiteness and Blackness, how important it is. So again, it's not just what you look like. It's not even about your ability to fit in.
Mm-hmm.
It's people still looking at blood.
Still
to make some determination about your value.
Mm-hmm.
And whether or not she deserves to wear the crown. And let's not talk about all the single white women she probably pissed off, because she snagged, she snagged the Duke.
Right. Okay, so there's a question that's also about kind of biological determinism, like in different contexts. So about sort of what is, the question is framed as thinking about like the Nazis determining this question of who is Jewish, and I think can be abstracted to like other examples, genocidal examples. And I guess the way I would ask the question is sort of what distinguishes, or modify the question a little bit, but what distinguishes how the one drop rule operates, I guess, in Black life, right? Not just in terms of how it is applied to people, but how it is lived for us historically, because you began by not completely dismissing it, right? Which I think is what we do with most kind of biological determinism, but something different happened for us, right?
Yes, I think it's historically talking about people who didn't have choice. Mm-hmm. Enslaved and oppressed people who were given their identities. Again, before, you know, our ancestors got on boats, or before they were colonized in the home country, they had their own identities. They had their own names for themselves. Getting to a space where you're oppressed and enslaved, all of that identity is conflated, yeah, right? And flattened into whatever it is the colonizer or the enslaver calls you. They called us Negro. They called us colored. They called us Black, right? We had to take that on. They gave us a rule that said that mixing would produce more of us. What could we do about it?
Mm-hmm.
What could we do about it? And so I think for so many of us, again, we don't question the one drop rule. It's just been our lived experience.
Right.
It's also where we get mama's baby, papa's maybe, because the one drop rule, right, changed the system. Whereas in Europe, patrilineal people, the child takes the status of the father. Insert this historical moment, this rule. It essentially says for these enslavers who have a thing for raping enslaved African women and producing children, these children are not your responsibility. We've now changed the system such that the child takes the status of the mother.
Mm-hmm.
What could we do about that?
It's such an important point, because I think it's a key to the history that I think very few people contemplate, right? I guess, and you know, another question that I think is related to that point is, thinking about the gate, you know, how should we talk about the gatekeeping of Blackness?
Yeah.
And I mean that not just in terms of, you know, color, but also with the more recent, you know, collection of people who are claiming Blackness who have no known Black African origin or identities, or have fictionally constructed these personal histories.
Right.
Yeah,
I know you're talking about Rachel Dolezal.
Yes. And a whole group of other professors too, right? Yeah, but yes.
Right. But and it brings up, I tried to stay out of the conversation before because it just seemed so ridiculous. Didn't want to give her any more attention. She's still getting attention, you know, for her own issues, because they are issues. But I think the gatekeeping, a few things. I think the issue with the likes of a Rachel Dolezal or a Jessica Krug or folks who are taking on identity is what we might see in the academy. Somehow these become the people who become chairs of African American studies or the chair of Latinx studies, right? So that's colorism and exceptionalism in another way. Mm-hmm. But just, you know, in theory, that you have the choice, again, choice. Right. You have the option to choose an identity, but you do it in a way that actually takes the opportunity from actual living, you know, real life Black people.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Right? But again, insert colorism, because then the question becomes for the broader public, which Blackness are you most comfortable with?
Right. Yes.
So again, when we're in this space of diversity, inclusion, equity, and belonging, and white folks want a checklist on how not to get in trouble, and you're being told that you have to create a diverse environment, and you only think about diverse as other, okay, you see, I need a Black, well, you're Black, works for me. Because again, the thing we have to understand about our physical presentation of race, for some folks, just being Black is a threat. That's just right. Being Black, you know, requires that folks confront their own stuff, right? And so if you don't have to bring your dark Black self in my face, y'all, but maybe I can forget about it. Mm-hmm. But if you, Rachel, or you, Jessica, you say you're Black, I get credit for you being Black, we're good.
I love that, because it flips another question that was asked, which is about, you know, so do we ask people with diversity, equity, inclusion about their identities? And instead you point to what does it mean if they're, even when you try to racially diversify, you avoid people mm-hmm. who are browner than a paper bag, right?
Right.
That's something that needs to be
addressed.
So there's two questions. I'm gonna put them together, right? One is, how does DNA test fit into this conversation with the DNA testing? And then a related question is, this, you know, think about the shift in the 1930 census, in which, as I said, the official instructions told the census takers to treat people with any known Negro ancestry as Negro, right? Which I think you've discussed, but it is interesting. Like you see these people who in the earlier senses are defined as mulatto, and then in 1930 as Negro. And so I guess it's sort of all the what people are trying to think about is, what about the intersection between this idea of measuring biology mm-hmm. versus the visual.
Mm-hmm. So again, when we start to think about Blackness as a political identity, as a lived identity, right? Mm-hmm. The kinds of questions we have about what is Blackness go above and beyond DNA and blood, if we recognize it as a lived experience, perhaps, right? So, you know, people bring in the kinds of, you know, so many people now are doing their ancestry, .com and 23andMe, and coming to discover, you know, what their genetic origins are. But if you've lived your life in a particular way for X amount of years, and then as an adult, you take a test and it tells you that you have 20% African ancestry, are you ready to claim a Black identity?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, right. What would that mean? So I think there's value in DNA, right? But again, because of all of this nuance and all of these changings over time, you bring up the census, for example, what changes in your lived experience in that time, particularly when we're at the height of passing, right? If somebody was allowed to be mulatto, and now here you come telling them they're Negro, their life is going to change, right? Or think of imitation of life. If you're getting away with being white and somebody sees a little kink in your hair and says, no, actually you're Negro, your life is going to change, right? In this moment, is your life going, like, you're not required to change, if that makes sense. It's just more information that you have. And so when we sit in this moment and have these questions about what is Blackness, we have to go beyond biology, I think.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. It's interesting. You know, one of the other folks asked about blood quantum with Indigenous people. And of course, you know, we can't prescribe what groups not our own use to define themselves.
Right.
But there is that point about experience is still relevant, right? Because there are plenty of Black people who are members of Indian nations who don't, right? Like, and
what does that mean?
What does that mean? Yeah.
Yeah. Beyond the blood, what does that mean?
Right.
And when we start blurring these lines, I think the thing that I caution about is that, particularly as we talk about white supremacy as an institution and an ideology, and many of us, regardless of our color and ethnicity and background, also being agents of white supremacy, right? Also living by way of white supremacist ideology, something makes me like, it's something prickly there, that if we're willing to change identity based upon blood, you can claim a quote unquote Native identity and have very problematic ideations about who Native American folk are. Or Black folk or whomever, right? Like, again, like, it's not just enough about the blood. And even for those of us, again, recognizably Black, some of us are also invested in white supremacy.
Deeply.
Right? In terms of how we regard one another. So, you know, all your kinfolk, all your skin folk, not your kinfolk, like, what you look like can also be enough. And that's what I'm trying to get us. And again, I don't have the answers. I'm just saying, wouldn't this be an interesting conversation for us to start thinking about? What is our investment in Blackness and for what purpose?
Yeah, we'll see, but I think you're shifting the questions being asked in some sense becomes, at least for me, an answer, right? Because it's very easy to ask the wrong questions about Blackness and race, right? So it's really profound. I wanna read this question in full because it's a complex one.
Okay.
So she says, I do feel that sometimes conversations about Blackness are American centric. This idea of Afro Latinx for me is very much an American creation. Mm. As a Haitian woman, it's hard to sometimes to communicate to Americans the importance of culture. I'm foremost Haitian and Black second.
Mm.
However, in the US, I'm compelled to refer to myself as African American.
Mm-hmm.
African American.
Mm-hmm. Yes, agreed, right? I recognize that. And again, when the construct of race is out of our control, when people are seeking political correctness, right? The language that they use may not reflect our identities. And for, again, if Blackness is a global identity, understand how many people's identities are conflated.
Yes,
right. When you put African-American next to the box. Though I am technically African-American, right. My parents are not.
Yes, right.
Now, Black, they can check. If we understand Black to be a broader political identity under which Ghanaian would fall.
Yes.
Right? That's reaching better than African-American, right? Or I still laugh when I see forms that say Caucasian. How many white people are Caucasian?
Right.
That is a very small area zone it's a question I should research. How did we come to start referring to white people as Caucasian? Does it sound better? You know what I mean? Does it sound more, I don't know, something? The identity was created as white. It was white. It was white. It wasn't European anything, which is why over time that box has shifted. Right? Because Jews haven't always been white. Italians haven't always been white. North Africans haven't always been white. They're white right now. You know, and so I agree with what the person who asked the question, is saying, because culture is so, again, because in this context, many of us have bought into the idea that we are a minority. We are a minority in this country. We are not a minority in the world, right? Understanding Blackness is a global identity. So many cultures across the world can fit into the idea of a Black political identity, but culturally, we can be connected. Mm-hmm. Black in Haiti looks like something different than Black in Ghana, than Black in Brazil. You see, you know, it's Black, but culturally, that's the thing that gives each of us our unique flavor. And that's why we hold on to that identity. Yes, politically, we're all Black. But there are things that are unique and beautiful about us based upon our histories, our lived experience, our location. And we shouldn't be required to let that go just to fit into a very archaic idea of identity in the United States. Yeah.
And you know what that makes me think of is how, of all groups of non-white people in this country, Black, there's no space in the census still, even though they keep talking about it, for ethnicity, right? So mm-hmm. after the second generation, there's no tracing, right? And that strikes me as part of the limitation of the way in which Blackness is constructed by those in power, right? So what you say about the reimagining of political Blackness as having this complexity to it actually really does strike at the heart of the, you know, the way white supremacy has been definitive in how we ascribe race in this country.
Because as you're speaking, Imani, it makes me think of, like, if we're thinking of what we're talking about ultimately is research, right? We are gathering data. We talk about the census, right? We're gathering quantitative data, right? And so when we construct research, when we design research, we know what it is we're ultimately seeking to find and or what we hope the numbers will tell us. Mm-hmm. But when you say there's still no room for ethnicity, do they care about ethnicity?
Right.
Is that what they're trying to measure?
No, right?
This is why I say we have to get out of this delusion of we are the world. Mm-hmm. We have to get out of this delusion of diversity, and we're so, oh my God, all these cultures, I'm so interested. Are you? You gonna do something different with us based upon culture? No, we are still stuck in an ideation of race that is white, Black. Yeah. Which box, because again, we can feel good. Tiger can check other and write Cabla Nation, but when that paper goes in the back where that data is codified, that Cabla Nation is going back in the Black box. So you can feel like you have some choice and some option. They're going to do with it what they will.
So, okay. So that there's a follow-up question to the previous one, but I actually want to pivot to something else, which is about the involuntary passing experience. Who are passed.
Okay.
Right. Who, you know, and the question is, what is the place or space for those who involuntarily pass? But I guess I also want to expand that question about how you think about, you know, Black people writ large, what ought to be our relationship to when people are past, not choosing to pass.
Right.
You know.
I'm not sure. I feel like I need to sit with that for a minute. It makes me think about everyone who's in the book. Lots of folks who are in the book, mm-hmm. right? That are saying, hey, like, I'm not saying that I'm white. I'm not trying to be seen as anything other than what I am. But unless I'm walking around with a sign or, you know, a sticker on my shirt, how would people know? For some people, it's a very hurtful experience. For some people, they accept it for what it is and they live their, it's more about how they live their life, right? So and I think developmentally, we go through phases, all of us. Like, I feel like I'm a different person in relationship to my Blackness when I started this project than I am now. You know what I mean? Like, I've had enough arguments and enough fights to know that I'm not arguing with people about identity. If right. you say you mix, you biracial, have fun. You say you Black, that's cool. You know what I mean? Like, and not to be dismissive of it, but just to say, like, you can't force anybody to take on identity if they're invested, you know, in another one. So, like, again, when I think about Blackness in the political realm, when I think about it in historical moments, again, thinking about the history of colorism, thinking about the hard color lines that were drawn, how many of our Black leaders, right, could have passed, chose not to, to fight for the cause, or may have passed so that they could
fight
for the cause. You know what I mean? So like, and it's not my experience, so I hope it doesn't sound like I'm dismissing it and saying it's not important. But when we think from a political standpoint, there could be some usefulness to that. Well,
and you, I mean, the book does a beautiful job of being sensitive to the complexity of that experience, right? What does it mean to be ascribed identities that aren't yours, to be non-recognized by people who you consider part of your community, right? I mean, that's, it's, and I guess that's part of what I wanted to say in response to some of the questions as well, because, you know, there are questions about, well, that people are asking about, you know, what about, you know, the street race, the race that you're treated on the street. What about the fact that Black means something different in various places, right? That I think that part of what happens is people actually want a definitive answer to a thing that does not have definitive answers, right?
Yeah, because that would make things so much simpler.
Right.
I mean, I think this, and again, it's not to dismiss any of these. These are all realities. Like street race is real. How are you seen and how are you received on the street, you know? But also, I don't know if it can be that simple. So for example, many people in the book, their street race might be other, if not white, right? But what does their lived experience, meaning like familial experience, like if your family lives in a particular, that's why it's questions of like bigger than what you look like, bigger than the DNA, like what is your lived experience of Blackness? So imagine having a lived experience of Blackness only to be told out in the world that you're not. We would be talking about them if they erase their Blackness to just take the whiteness.
Absolutely.
You know, so again, I don't know what we want. I don't know how else to say it.
Yeah. And do we know?
I don't think we know what we want.
Right. What we want is to be free of white supremacy, but right. Because that's, I think often that seems so elusive, then we have these other things we do about loyalty and membership, but really that's the heart of it.
And I think ultimately for me, it's not to simplify it as much as it's to complicate it, you know, and to say that I don't have the answers. I don't know that we have the answers as we are, but that it's going to take work to start even moving towards answers, that we have to have the conversations and ask the questions, you know, to because for a lot of folks, these are questions that we've never had to consider in conversation or otherwise, particularly if we're not learning about race or thinking or being forced to think critically about race. Why would we even think about these things? We would keep it simple. What is your street race? How are you seen? That is what you are and who you are. And for me, having this experience in talking with all of the contributors, I know that it's not that simple. And because it's not my experience, right? I had to somehow, you know, pull back and allow their stories to lead, to get to some level of understanding.
I think there's so much to learn from that, right? That from, because we have a habit of, and we do this, you know, what is a police and what is Black? We do it in a funny way, culturally and stuff, but to actually look at Black experiences different than our own seems to be something that is imperative, especially right now.
But even the question of Blackness, Imani, as you were talking, I'm not gonna put your business in the street too far, but somebody might look at you, look at your accolades, see that you teach at Princeton, hear that you speak in a particular way, read the words and the ways that you write them, and think that you might question your Blackness. Because questions of Blackness are also about, like, you know, where people live, what people do, those kinds of things. But you so country. And people have to know you. People have to know you personally to know just what kind of country you are. You see what I'm saying? So, like, there's a fluidity even in the performance of our Blackness.
Right.
Also, who gets to decide what's Black enough?
Right. No, it's so true. And I, you know, it's funny because there's this essay that Richard Rodriguez wrote years ago, which I had this reckoning, where he talks about how for him, Spanish was a home language. It wasn't a public language. And for me, that's sort of how I feel about countryness, right? Because like, I'm, you know, that because growing up in the Northeast and being born, my family being in the Deep South, that's my private culture. It always, even with other Black folks, right? And so I do think there is something about, like, yeah, there's a different kind. It's not a physical passing, but it is a code switching and a distancing between myself and the public. And I think that's such an important point. You know, so I have this question, though, related to that, that I think you will enjoy. Because someone asked, you know, well, why does Blackness have to be defined by being harassed by the police? Doesn't. Or mistreated, or all those sorts of things.
Right. It doesn't, not exclusively, but we can't ignore that that's also a reality. Mm-hmm. I think for many of us, I hope that we're able to see our identities bigger than that, right? Because I certainly do. How depressing would it be to only see ourselves, again, in relation to white supremacy through the lens of white supremacy? Yes. But I understand the question, because so often that becomes the reference point. So often.
Yeah. Right. Someone asked about how you think of Afro-pessimism in relation to these questions.
I'm not so well versed in Afro-pessimism. Tell me more.
Well, I'm probably not the person because to tell you more, but I do think, you know, much of it is a kind of defining of Black experience through the logics of white supremacy, that Blackness is the experience of being the ultimate other, that global systems have been created around Blackness, and a kind of resistance to, I think, what a lot, you know, and please forgive me if folks disagree with this, but a lot of what you do and what I try to do, is, which is about sort of claiming the beauty of Black life,
yes,
as such, right? Yes. So that, you know, not allowing that to be the definition,
right?
Of what it means to be Black, right?
The only lens, yeah. And also recognizing, and I can speak for me, I think I can speak for you too, Imani, is that to have certain conversations and to do certain work to call out white supremacy for what it is, mm-hmm. to recognize our position and our relationship to white supremacy is necessary. We also take the time to point out the beauty and the joy, the culture and the history, right? That for me, that's even part of our power, is that despite this, or maybe even because of this, you can't kill us, for real, for real. When you start talking about cultural connections all over the diaspora and what remained and what lived, ultimately what's stronger? You can't kill culture.
You cannot.
You can't kill ancestry, you can't kill spirit. So it's like both and. We still have to address a particular reality, mm-hmm. but we can't ignore it or allow it to be a substitute for our other lived realities as well.
I completely agree, as you know well. And you know, there's another flip of the question. I'm sorry for the folks asking questions, because I'm flipping them around a little bit and like putting them together. But someone asked, Dr. Blay, have you noticed a difference in folks responding to you and your Blackness since the book coming out? And I want to shift it a little bit to talk about, you know, there is a way of being perceived on the street also when you are undeniably Black that allows you to have certain windows into experience that if you walked around with your CV and your resume,
right,
people would watch themselves a little more.
Right, right, right. Yeah, I've never had my Blackness called into question, at least not to my face. Right. At least not to my face. But I also can admit, like, again, sometimes I'm too Black for my own good. I'm so committed to showing up Black. I don't even want to give you the opportunity to start questioning my Blackness, my alignment, my commitment, my perspective. You know what I mean? It's that important to me.
Yeah.
I would probably be surprised to know if somebody had questions about my Blackness. Perhaps the closest the conversation has ever gone is a question about, because I am first generation, mm-hmm. you know, because my family's from Ghana, I'm the first person to be born in the United States, you know? And so that's probably more of a question about how much perhaps I fit into American culture. But I think there's a whole body of work we need to do on that first generation experience. Like, you want to talk about code switching.
Yes, and how it's regionally distinct, right? It's all, because, you know, it's interesting, and it's taken us a little bit away from the book, but I think it's related to it, because when people talk about, you know, racial ambiguity and how you're seen, there are so many cues that and complexities that exist for where you fit as a Black person, even if you were not seen as phenotypically ambiguous, right? Like, people who, it's also the case that browner than a paper bag, people have different languages spoken to them at various times, different assumptions based on name, all these sorts of things. And I think we can actually use this experience to actually open up the conversation.
Absolutely. What if I walked into, you know, here in Philadelphia, for better or for worse, they call them poppy stores. What if I walked into the poppy store speaking Spanish? Like, cause that's the thing that always gets me. Like, when I walk into certain spaces and y'all feel comfortable, I know you're talking about me. You feel comfortable, right? And I do, because I speak a little Spanish, right? Absolutely. I know that you're speaking about me as if I don't understand. How would you know? I could be from Panama.
Of course. Or the Dominican Republic.
Or Cuba, or anywhere. Puerto Rico,
right. I mean, yes, right.
So, you know, in that moment, you don't know my background. When I think of so many folks that I've grown up with, when I think of, oh, I'm going to forget the brother's name, or I'm going to butcher it. It's an artist, a rapper from Houston. He's dope. Tobe.
Oh, Ngwiwe, yes.
Nigerian American.
Amazing.
If it wasn't for his name or for him telling us so, he a regular Houston boy, regular Texas. You see what I'm saying? Like, so again, that dance. And I'm sure when he gets to his mama's house, he knows how to eat his fufu with his hands. You know what I'm saying? Yes. And so, yeah. Yeah.
It's funny. I'm going to let you finish with, you know, final thoughts, but I just thought about this experience of being with my best friend who is Haitian American in the Dominican Republic, and being on the beach and having, you know, people speak Creole to her, and then ask her, well, is she, referring to me, is she okay? Because we get the most racism from dark-skinned Dominicans.
Oh, wow.
Right, so that, like, it wasn't a question about my Blackness, but about the way the idea of race acts as a proxy for difference, right? So, like, so it was really a kind of profound moment, because we draw all these, and that, you know, and I don't mean to pick on Dominicans in that instance. I think we all do that in our various national contexts, make these hierarchies.
Sure.
Within Blackness, and they're not just color, right?
Sure. But I, you know, and I don't want to pick on Dominicans either, because I think they get picked on quite enough. Yes. But I do think it's important to contextualize why that was a wow moment for me, right? Because for them to think that you're a dark-skinned Dominican, and also know that in their experience, they get the most racism from dark-skinned Dominicans, says a lot about the investment of dark-skinned Dominicans in rejecting Haitian American, you know, because that seems to be so much of the tension that at least I've heard and read about, you know, between Dominicans and Haitians, right? Whereas Dominicans are on one side of the island asking the rest of us, asking the West, don't see us like them.
Yes, right.
You know how big that island is? Y'all know y'all all cousins, right?
Of course.
Don't see us like them, because Haiti will always be punished for the revolution.
Well, that's it. Because I was just about to ask you, and is there a location on the globe that you think is the most pointed location for this point about the constructions of Blackness? Would Haiti be that, or one of them?
Definitely one of them.
Yeah.
Haiti will never be forgiven for the revolution, and we see it play out, it's in our face. We may not want to name it, we may not want to connect those dots. That's why the issue, and there's work that I want to do on that island. That's why the relationship between Dominicans and Haitians is so important to me to understand differently, or at least to call out and to name for what it is, because we say Dominicans get a bad rap, right? For their anti-Blackness, but there is a history there. It didn't just fall out of the sky. They're not unique other than that history. Like, we see anti-Blackness all over the world. We see anti-Blackness all over Latinidad, but there's something very specific happening on that island that needs to be named.
And it becomes a global history, right?
Absolutely. Because how dare you Haitians choose freedom? How dare you?
On that note, that beautiful note, thank you so much for this conversation and this extraordinary, brilliant, beautiful book and for all that you do.
Thank you, Imani, so much. And thank y'all for coming.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/author events.